The 1939 World's Fair was like its own world. It covered hundreds of acres in Flushing Meadows, Queens. It had buildings, restaurants, exhibits. It even had its very own song, written by George Gershwin. Or at least it was sketched out by Gershwin, who died in 1937, after which Kay Swift is said to have finished the song, a march called Dawn of a New Day.
And the brass roll the drum, for the world of tomorrow we come. See the sun through the gray, it's the dawn of a new day.
The world of tomorrow was the theme and the title of the fair, and it was very specifically aimed at that moment. A decade after the stock market crash, Americans having been beaten down throughout the 1930s.
And I think, probably above all else in the 1930s, there's a pretty strong political motivation.
Robert Rydell of Montana State University studies, teaches, and writes about world's fairs.
And that motivation is to really persuade people that this American democratic system is something that can endure and really can rise to meet the economic challenges of the Great Depression.
The world of tomorrow and the world of today stretching out before you as far as the eye can see.
The fair spends 4 years creating itself with a budget of $155 million, what would be roughly $2.3 billion now.
And that money comes overwhelmingly from private sources. It comes from corporations. It also comes from the federal government.
I hereby dedicate the World's Fair.
Roosevelt is very interested in using World's Fairs to promote the New Deal.
And I declare it open to all mankind.
So there were powerful forces at work, creating powerfully optimistic images.
First of all, I love the Trilon in Paris Fair. That was the symbol of the New York World's Fair.
The Trilon was 700 feet high. The Paris Fair was 200 feet around. It towered over Jack Macy, who went on to become a distinguished designer himself of World's Fair exhibits, displays, and pavilions. Macy traveled to the fair from Brooklyn many times as a teenager and was dazzled by those structures.
It was brilliant. Gleaming white tower and a ball. It was fantastic, which could be seen from every part of the fair.
Come, let's travel into the future. What will we see?
Out in full force were the displays of corporate strength and ingenuity.
This wonder world of 1960.
Like the General Motors Pavilion named Futurama.
I found this awesome.
Which literally placed you in a kind of American dream landscape.
The world we are now seeing is a vision, an artistic conception.
You were transported around a giant diorama, showing animated highways, cars going in all directions, multi-levels, beautiful parks. It was totally breathtaking.
There was a celebrated diorama named Democracy City, a vision of an orderly, splendid metropolis with choral music playing and pulsing colored lights marking its streets. Westinghouse had its own futuristic pavilion.
And there they featured demonstrations of a robot called Electro.
And here he comes, ladies and gentlemen, walking up to greet you.
I thought that was marvelous, too, especially when they had this robot smoking.
You may now smoke this cigarette. Oh, yes, Electro, you do need a light, too, don't you?
All right, here you are.
And there was a remarkable combination of cultural strains. On one side of the fair, the pianist Solomon, premiering the piano concerto of Sir Arthur Bliss. On the other, gaudy strip shows advertised by carnival barkers. The Heinz 57 Pavilion gave out free pickles. There were long lines every day. Showing daily at the fair was the film The City, with a Lewis Mumford vision of the future and an Aaron Copland score.
New cities take form, green cities. They're built into the countryside.
I think one of the things you really have to remember is for young people, you can imagine what it would have been like coming of age in the Great Depression. And there's a sense of uncertainty about where we're going. And you go to the New York World's Fair in 1939 and you see Futurama. You see all of these products and these technologies and the President of the United States giving assurances about how the world really is going to be a better place. And you leave with a sense of hope, excitement, and those memories stick.
in spite of, or maybe because of, all that was happening at that time. War was looming, and the international tensions played out right there in Flushing Meadows.
The Nazis, the Germans, pulled out. They didn't put a pavilion up. There's a bomb blast in the British pavilion. The Czech pavilion is draped in black. The Soviets actually pull out in 1940. So, yes, World War II.
The society is living out its domestic deficiencies at the fair, too, because in 1939, America was, after all, a deeply divided country.
There's an enormous protest organized because African Americans are very upset about the discrimination taking place on the fairgrounds. The limited employment they're getting is really menial jobs. There are picket lines organized around the fair on opening day.
The World's Fair in its two seasons is said to have employed tens of thousands, maybe 50,000 people at one time or another. But
we're talking about mostly whites working. The world of tomorrow, as envisioned by the planners of the fairs, is a world of tomorrow that looks awfully, awfully white.
So the 1939 World's Fair was the 1939 world there in Queens. From the most sublime futuristic creations to the most happily ridiculous down and dirty escapism, it was all there, for 75 cents for an adult and a quarter for a kid.
You've come away from the fairs with your mind enlivened, your imagination stretched.
This is the last week of the greatest fair ever staged by man in the history of the world.
For me, it was entering paradise. I didn't want to leave that place.
If it's been reduced to a collectible ashtray with a Trilon and Perisphere logo, that may be because, as they say, you had to be there, ready to escape to another era, ready, despite the failings of the system, to look ahead in a dark time. For WNYC, I'm Sarah Fischko.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.